Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, let's have that sound again.
Oh, okay, hang on, there it is.
That one?
Oh, the creepy, eerie sound. That's because this is Eerie House, Holy Tiny Radio. Welcome, everyone. I must have left the window open. I may have to close it. Good evening and welcome.
I thought you were in the basement.
No wonder these windows are so dark. Anyway. Explains a lot. Good evening. Welcome. Eerie House, Oldie Timey Radio. Dale K here from Spook Show, here along with
Dave Bagley from Weird, this really bad movie, and Spaceship One, and here along with
it is I, Guy the Ghoul, blah, blah, to you all from the Horrible Heart of Stein, Guy the Ghoul, blah, blah, there you go. All right.
My madcap friends here helping me bring you some old-time radio, or helping all of us bring old-time radio to you folks, and tonight we're climbing that mountain.
Yep. Foxberry must be climbing with us too. He's listening on tonight on location for Sportac Radio, whatever that is.
Sporadic.
Oh, sporadic. Okay.
There you go.
I see. I thought it was a name brand. Hi, have you tried the new Sporadic?
In other words, I'm thinking his connection isn't that great, but that's okay.
Cleans teeth in 12. Yeah.
Yeah. Or it's blog
anyway.
Talk. Yeah. It's blog talk messing with the chat again. Who knows?
Yeah.
You never know around.
Thanks, blog talk.
Yep.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Some cool radio tonight.
Yeah. We're climbing to the mountaintops with suspense, Quiet Please, and for the first time ever on Eerie House, The Goon Show from, the BBC. And we got Peter Sellers, no?
Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan, who was the writer-creator and one of the many voices in this, as well as Harry Secombe, who was basically known kind of as a singer at that particular time. Until he got to be crazy with the goons.
Was John Cleese ever associated with the Goon Show?
Only because it was a big influence in his sense of humor. They were very, I guess the Wikipedia calls them subversive and absurdist. The Goon Show exercised considerable influence in the development of British and American comedy in popular culture. It was cited as a major influence by the Beatles, certainly with their Help movie, the American comedy troupe Firesign Theater, and the British comedy troupe Monty Python. And I've heard John Cleese in many interviews certainly refer back to The Goon Show as what a major influence it was on his and many British comedians. Their absurdist views and how they did things certainly fits in with Monty Python and so many of the programs, the sketch programs before Monty Python came along.
Could be.
And of course, it's not documented too heavily, but all the pantomime was performed by our friend and colleague, Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pantomime on radio. Ernest is the guy. Uh-huh. He can do it.
Uh-huh.
GGSID joined us here in the chat as well.
Thank you.
And I think Fogsbane is genuinely traveling. He said he's going over a mountain, literally. Maybe that's why he's going in and out of the chat there. We don't know.
Oh, my.
I will still blame Blog Talk Radio. How's that?
Oh, come on. National Peppermint Patty Day, that's the best they could do? All these great national days and Peppermint Patty Day.
I would think there would be a Lucy Van Pelt Day before there's a Peppermint Patty Day myself.
I ran across an amazingly funny little meme with Lucy Van Pelt, and it says, counting to 10 only makes it premeditated.
Somehow that makes sense
counting
to
from
me.
10. About counting from 10. Isn't that what you're supposed to do?
Count
oh, no,
10.
You count to 10.
Didn't
right,
kill
right,
them.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I just made it premeditated. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you did. I
there
like
you
it. Did.
I'll
counting
run with
again.
That. You could have saved that for a moral, but that's okay. I'm sure there's more morals to come later in the show.
There are two morals. I did not perform a moral appendage for the Goon Show.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't.
Well, I'll give you your moral early. Listen to more Goon Show.
There you go.
Oh.
Yeah.
And we'll be bringing you more, too, as we work them in.
Yeah, an interesting thing about the Goon Show is that they have certain characters and certain catchphrases, and the more you hear the shows and you catch those, the more smiles it brings to your face. It's such an interesting show. I mean, this thing ran for, over 200, 238 episodes and a matter of 12 specials over a 10-year period. Just absolutely, absolutely amazing. They started off, when they first started on the show, and none of the first season, at least, exist recordings of it anywhere can be found. They went from 370,000 people in their first few weeks, and by the end of their 17th show, they had nearly 2 million people. They grew from 370,000 to over 2 million people in 17 weeks. Just wow,
wow. Especially back then, the population wasn't as dense as it is now. That's truly amazing.
Yeah. Yes.
Dense in numbers or IQ?
The answer is yes.
So, Dave, do you know if
if
the Goon Show has any ties to Round the Horn, which was a radio show, a comedy radio show?
Only that they were both from the BBC. I think that Round the Horn came after that. That was more of a 1960s program, where this really ran 51 through 1960, pretty much, with a few specials here and there, including the very last Goon Show of all, which I have on vinyl, only to find out later on that there's it was done live in front of an audience on the BBC, and that is available on YouTube for all to see.
Ooh.
So that was really a joy for me to see something I'd heard for so many episodes.
You were talking about a lot of catchphrases that were picked up and continued with the Goon Show. I was minding my own business this week, and all of a sudden I said to myself, "What is this?" And I broke out laughing because it's exactly what Basil Rathbone said in The Comedy of Terror every time he wrote, "What is this?" And I just started laughing at myself.
This? Yeah. Every time they tried to kill him.
Well, let's say
every once in a while.
Let's say we save the good stuff for last. Not that it's not all good, but the exciting stuff. I am looking forward to the Goon Show so much. This is my first time ever hearing a Goon Show show. Did I say that right? Goon Show show? Why
yes,
not?
You did. A Goon Show show, yeah.
It works. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where shall we begin on the serious side?
Oh, well, you're saving Goon Show for last. Okay. We have suspense and we have Quiet, Please.
Quiet, Please.
All right, Gar, we'll go with that.
Do we want to start with Quiet, Please?
Yeah.
Good old Ernest Chappell along with
Ernest Borgnine.
Actually, they kind of look like they could be Ernest Borgnine. but good old Willis Cooper, who, of course, created the Lights Out program, which he left in 1936 to go proceed to do other things, as well as the last season of the Campbell Playhouse, which also was the Mercury Theater Group, and then came back in 1949 to create this series, which ran for 48. Anyway, it ran for two episode series, one the season on Mutual, then the second season was on, I think it was CBS. So, and I always think it was interesting that Ernest Chappell, who is the main character in every one of these episodes, never was billed as a dramatic actor or anything, but yet he was like Well, he was billed as basically the man telling the story or something, your voice telling the story or something like that. Well, giving his name Ernest Chappell, of course. But what a unique, I don't know of any other show which used that did this the same way, using the guy who was the central, but being actually part of the story and a different character each time. I don't know of any other show that did it like that. Do you, Gar?
I do not.
Alrighty then.
Let's
get started here then with Quiet Please, a tale called How Beautiful the Mountain, originally broadcast way back.
Oh, yes. Hang on. I got it.
A long time ago.
Monday, May 3rd, 1948. I even put the day in there.
Quiet, please.
You guys shut up.
Go to bed.
For the love.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet, Please for tonight is called How Beautiful Upon the Mountain.
I don't say that Mount Everest will never be successfully climbed. I don't say that at all. What I do say, however, is that no one will ever successfully climb Everest and come back. Yes, I know they said that about the Matterhorn, and Edward Whymper climbed it. Whymper was the man who first stated what many mountain climbers insist is the creed of their arduous calling. You don't know that? Well, it was many years ago, after he'd made the first successful ascent of the Matterhorn. Someone asked him why he could not see a mountain without wanting to climb it. His reply was simple, and it's become historic. Because it's there, he said. And mountain climbers the world over will solemnly assure you that that is their reason, too. I beg to differ. I think there's another reason. A compulsion in the hearts of certain brave men and women that has existed since the beginnings of time. A compulsion that they very probably never realize is there. A compulsion that is revealed only to a rare few of those that lift up their eyes to the hills. I think it is because the mountains have always been the earthly abiding place of divinity. I think it's because certain mortals are consumed by a subconscious cosmic curiosity to find the abode of the gods, by an urge to seek and an overpowering hope to find naked divinity at last incarnate on the roof of the world. But these divinities do not welcome human intrusion. Men have walked upon the peak of Mount Olympus, where Zeus and Hera, Pallas Athena, and Aphrodite dwelt, and have not found them. Quetzalcoatl has departed from the high peak to the Mexican Cordilleras, where men have vainly sought him there. And though the specter of the Brocken sometimes appears today, the traveler knows it to be only the magnified image of himself. But still, the ancient secret compulsion exists, and men climb mountains because of it. In all the recorded history of the world, no known man has ever conquered Everest. The reason? Well, they speak of unclimbable walls, of the lethargy that comes from lack of oxygen. They speak of insufferable cold, of howling winds and sudden storms, of impassable crevasses and monstrous avalanches. And these things are true. I've experienced them myself. But there are avalanches and crevasses and winds and snow and cold on other mountains, and men have climbed them. Could it be that the gods have tired of retreating and have set a barrier on this, their last refuge, against the men of the plains? No man has ever looked upon the summit of Everest more than 5 miles above the level of the distant sea. Many men have flown near Everest, hoping for a glance at the highest spot on Earth, but Everest has evaded them. In a motion picture that the Marquis of Clydesdale made more than 15 years ago when he became the first man to fly over the mountain, the eternal veil, the plume of Everest, reached out and covered the peak. You haven't heard of that? Well, if you ever have an opportunity to see those pictures, go. Perhaps what you see will help convert you to my way of thinking. Ceaselessly, day in and day out, in sunshine and in storm, a great plume of ice crystals and powder snow streams out from the crest of the mountain, the terrible white banner that can instantly become a great whip to lash down at the mountain's own flanks as if to drive off some intruder toiling up the incredible slopes to the virgin summit. Yes, I have seen that. Others have seen it too. Irvine and Lee Mallory saw it, the two men who came closest to the top. And the others of their party saw the plume snatch at them as they struggled upward. And when it lifted again, they had disappeared. No man has seen them since. They did find the ice axe Lee Mallory carried. They found it far down the slopes from where the plume snatched the two men away. And it was curiously bent and twisted, the sturdy, high-tension steel. I met John Chandos when I was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. We became great friends through our mutual interest in mountain climbing. I wish you could have seen John Chandos standing before the mantel in my rooms at Oxford on a bleak, rainy day in early autumn.
I'm fed to the teeth, Hugh, with this place. Let's chuck it and go somewhere. Climb a mountain nobody else has climbed.
Now, what mountain, old boy?
Well, Everest by choice.
You got 50,000 pounds?
I could get it.
All right, let's go.
I mean it. I could get it.
Where?
Never mind where. Now, look, would you come?
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Oh, I wish you were.
I tell you I am.
Yeah, of course, you know it'd probably be the end of it.
Rather have it that way than drying up bit by bit in Oxford. Wouldn't you?
I would. Yes.
Well, then?
I haven't a cent. A shilling, I mean.
You won't need it. I've got plenty.
Well, why Everest?
Look, Brent, old boy. Ever since I was a child, I've had one, only one, ambition. You got a cigarette? To see the top of Everest. And I'm going to. Come along, do it. Now, what are you laughing at?
Well, just the casual way you put it. Let's go see the top of Everest, you and I. Half the world away, 5 miles straight up, dozens of men have died and disappeared trying it. Let's go see the top of Everest.
Someone's going to do it one day, you know.
Yes, that's true.
Well, shall we be the one?
And on that casual basis, the Chandos-Brandt Mount Everest expedition began. We left Oxford. We left England after purchasing thousands of pounds worth of equipment, tents, windproof clothing, weapons and photographic equipment, dehydrated foods, batons, ice axes, cases of brandy, miscellaneous equipment by the hundredweight. And at last we were in Darjeeling, talking to men who knew the roof of the world, learning the names of obscure villages, where we might find guides to lead us to the upper reaches of the Great White Mountain. And a day came when our preparations were completed and a great deal of money spent, and we set out in motor cars to the final takeoff spot where no motor could go and only the feet of men had walked before. The native guides, as hard-bitted a crew as ever I saw, gathered around their tiny fires. We sat before our little tents and smoked and drank hot, sweet tea against the moon.
Glad, eh, Brent?
Yes, in a way. Not going to be pleasant, though.
Oh, won't be too bad for a while. Till we get up really high.
No. No worse than some places I've been. I wonder what's up there.
Can't tell much from the photographs, can we? Just ice and snow and rock.
And plenty of it.
Quite. You know, I was wondering something today.
What?
I was wondering if any of these native chaps have been up there.
On top?
Yes. They like them, you know, to be laughing at the silly white men. Coming halfway around the world to be the first man on top. While all the time, old Bunga and his nephew have been up there a dozen times. Good joke.
No, I doubt it, Chandos.
Oh, so do I, really. But you know these chaps?
None of them seem any too enthusiastic about going up.
Not if you go by the pay they'd insisted on.
Well, you know, Everest is some kind of a god or something to them.
Is to me, too.
What?
Why, I know it sounds silly, but maybe we're being sacrilegious or something. Maybe nobody's supposed to climb up there.
Not getting cold feet, are you?
Oh, no, not at all. They're quite warm, thank you. Oh, more of your American slang. No, I've not got the wind up, if that's what you mean. But...
Superstition.
I was thinking. I mean, I wonder what is waiting for us up there.
Cold and snow and ice and thin air.
Besides that?
What do you mean?
I'm remembering what that chap wrote about Irvine and Lee Mallory and the plume up there. Down it came, he said, like a sentient thing, like the hand of a god, and swept them away before my very eyes.
Now, look, you begin to worry about giants and things up there. You'd better stay here.
Oh, I'm not worried, Brent. I'm just curious. Somehow, I'm excited. Like a chap who's waiting to meet his bride at the church on his wedding day. I say, that's being a bit idiotic, isn't it? Look at her up there, cold and white and beautiful, not caring about us at all. We are coming up after you, old girl, if we die in the attempt.
And as I lay there in the firelight, listening to the quiet music that came from the shadowy groups of guides and bearers, a strange thought formed in my mind. Shouldn't John Chandos have said, and die in the attempt? And the sound of the little flute went on in the cold twilight, and presently we went to our tents and slept. And I dreamed of a woman's face, a bride's face on a high mountain. And somehow the face was the mountain itself, and the mountain was a face. And it was cold, icy cold. And a voice said in my ear something that I dimly remembered from the Bible, from Isaiah. How beautiful upon the mountain. And the music of the flute dissolved into a great crashing chord. And I awoke trembling in the blackness of a frigid morning. I need not tell you of the next few weeks of the ascent to the camp at 23,000 feet, hardly a mile below the summit. If you have climbed mountains, you will know it to be an endless nightmare of traversing great rocky slopes, of scaling precipitous walls, of making our way cautiously across the ice bridges that span crevasses as deep as infinity. Days of toiling upward, roped together sometimes, only to find the way blocked by a new fall of rock or a snowslide our guides had forgotten. Inching our way up rock chimneys, hammering our batons laboriously into the face of the living rock and climbing a foot at a time up walls where one misstep, one missed grip, would have sent both our bodies tumbling to a horrid death 1,000 feet below. Days of clawing our way through sudden snowstorms with a biting flake so thick that we'd lose each other at 10 feet distance. In the midday halts to gulp scalding tea, wolf down a bar of chocolate, and then rise and go on again. And behind us, the diminishing string of porters carrying our supplies, dropping off at regular intervals to set up camp against our return. If we should return. And then the agony of the last few thousand feet. At those heights, of course, exhaustion was our greatest enemy. The oxygen at 20,000 feet was pitifully thin. Each upward step is a lifetime. And the brain reels up there in the rarefied atmosphere that man is not meant to breathe. We made the 26,000-foot camp, and we climbed another 1,000 feet. I'm not sure whether the way grows more difficult as one goes higher. Perhaps the rock formations are no more forbidding at that elevation than they are at the lower levels. But here the strain on mind and muscle and heart is so magnified that the The slightest setback is enough to cause a strong man to fall down and weep loud, freezing tears of frustration. I remember that our guides would go no farther than we struggled upward alone that one morning. And at the end of the day, we were a bare 200 feet above them. It seemed to take half the night to get our tent pitched, and I have little doubt it actually did. And I sank into delicious sleep. And again I dreamed. I dreamed of the woman again. A surpassingly beautiful woman. With eyes like the crystals of ice that made up our world. And about her hair she wore a great white scarf, a kind of comb that moved as if it were a living thing. Billowing out over her shoulders, never still, seeming not to be blown by the wind, but to control the wind itself.
And I knew something about the wind.
Although my tired mind could not remember what it was I knew. And I tried to look into her eyes, but she was looking beyond me. And in my dream, I turned. And I knew she was looking at John Shadow. And on his face was a look of ineffable adoration. And when I turned to gaze at her again, the same look of love was in her eyes. And the veil, the plume whipped around, and I felt it brush my face like an icy lash.
Oh.
And she said, "Ooga booga."
Ooga booga. Yeah, this one was a little, for me, it had a little bit of a slow start, I guess a long intro, but boy, it got going quick.
Some of these do, but yeah, they don't disappoint in the end. I guess it was one of the great horror stories, series that people don't really talk a lot about.
The Quiet Place? Is The Quiet Place the one that only a handful exist? Is that the one, or is that another one? I know the Hermit's Cave, only a few exist.
The Witch's Tale. Most of the ones that exist are from Australia. Yeah, most of the ones that exist are from Australia.
Arg.
Here we go. Arg.
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 Arg. The Talons are doing cool. In fact, what's funny is he's the one that wrote every episode of Casey Crabb Photographer. All those are still around, but no. He destroyed the acetates, all the original acetates of The Witch's Tale, because he got mad because he couldn't syndicate them by mid 1960s.
That dirty rat.
Oh yeah, go back in time and stop him. You know, go back in time and stop that man.
Slap him.
Wait, Dave, didn't I send you a book that like was every script they ever made of The Witch's Tale?
There's a lot of background. It had about a dozen scripts on there of it. Yeah. Yeah. And that was transcribed by a. Yes.
Didn't I send you a book about that? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not every script. But there are, and some of those don't exist because those are transcribed from a fan, a big fan of the series.
Wow.
And he's the one to put the book together as well. And he did work with Alonzo Dean Cole's wife on that book as well. And this is interesting because even when getting back to Quiet Please, when Ernest Chappell was talking to the Willis Cooper's wife after he had passed, and he said, do you have all the recordings? And she said, no. He said, well, I have them all. And he sent her copies of every episode that he had of Quiet Please. And that may be today why we have a good deal. Now, are all the copies pristine and super clear? No. But, the transcription discs will pick up noise and things like that. But I'm so glad that he did that because that's one of the reasons we have all these wonderful Quiet Pleases today.
Yeah.
If we've got the scripts, there are definitely people out there that could remanufacture the audio, there's
clean
a collection
it up somewhat.
Same story, different, with different actors and actresses, and it would be amazing.
Well, maybe we should pick out a script and do that here on Erie House.
Wouldn't that be fun? Yep.
Okay. Erie House presents Quiet, Please. As long as I don't have to sing.
I love those songs we did.
I love them too, but I feel bad for how we've treated our audience. By making them hear it.
Okay.
Well, Dave, you know what that means. That means that Quiet Please presents the Sound of Music's completely out the window. No singing.
I'm every mountain. Over every stream.
Get me liquored up. I'll finish that one. All right. Let's finish up Quiet Please. Part two. How beautiful that there mountain.
Quiet Please.
You betcha.
Quiet Please.
That's the first part.
Quiet Please.
Quiet
That's
Please.
The first part.
Quiet Please.
That's the first part now.
Oh, you know why?
You part two?
Because it's labeled part two and it's 30 minutes long, Dave. You figure that one out.
Is
All right.
Really?
We are going to come back to part two of Quiet Please. But first, let's just take a little misdirection and listen to Dave panic in the background.
My mic is going off.
While Gar and I
panic,
cover
Dave,
for
panic.
Him.
Oh,
yep.
The closest I ever came to anything concerning mountains, I made it over to Norway back when I was in the old U.S. of something military thing going on there. And they told us, we're going to go to the Arctic Circle. And so you need to buy mountain climbing apparel so you don't freeze to death. it was kind of, when we made it to Norway, they said, all right, guys, see you later. There you go. Get off the ship. Go play. And that's kind of what they do. And a bunch of the folks, a bunch of the guys did what? They went skiing. Where in Norway? Where on the mountains? And they came back with broken arms and broken legs, and it was not good.
Every time someone says Norwegian, I want to say Swede, and that's only because of the movie The Thing with Kurt Russell.
Okay.
It's fun.
Yeah, so I had to get you could not, when we moved into the Arctic, you could not touch anything on the outside of the ship. You could not touch anything with your bare skin or you would stick.
Or you would lose it. The skin, that is.
Well, it would. Frostbite. You're going to lose a digit or something.
Nice.
So we were like completely just cocooned in all kinds of outerwear. But that was it. That's as close as I've gotten. It was like I had to buy mountain climbing long johns or whatever. Battery-operated socks. And this is someone from Florida.
Battery-operated long johns.
Watch where those wires go and you're okay.
Yep. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Search purple.
Friends, it's certainly true that when you smoke, you want smoothness, mildness, and deep down enjoyment. And that's precisely what you get with every Lucky Strike you light, because there's never a rough cup in a Lucky. Just think of that, friends. Luckies are always smooth, mild, and mellow every puff of the way. For you see, it takes fine tobacco to make a fine cigarette, and LSMFT, Lucky Strike, means fine tobacco. Now, fine tobacco costs more, and Luckies pay more. That's right. Luckies pay millions of dollars more than official parity prices to get ripe, mellow tobacco for your Lucky Strike. Just listen for a moment to what the tobacco experts say about the kind of leaf Lucky Strike buys. Take Mr. L. Garland Griffin, a tobacco auctioneer from Clarksville, Virginia, who recently said, all in all, I've sold over 100 million pounds of tobacco. And season after season, I've seen Lucky Strike buy fine tobacco. Prime, ripe leaf. The kind of tobacco for downright good smoking. I've smoked Lucky's regularly for 14 years. Now there's a tip for you, friends, from a man who really knows tobacco. So for your own deep-down smoking enjoyment, light up a Lucky. You'll agree with the tobacco experts, with the millions who choose Lucky's for a finer, milder, smoother smoke. Yes, puff after puff, pack after pack. There's never a rough puff in a Lucky. Good reason to make your next carton Lucky's.
I dreamed of the woman again. A surpassingly beautiful woman. With eyes like the crystals of ice that made up our world.
I guess this is part two.
And about her hair, she wore a great white scarf, a kind of plume that moved as if it were a living thing. Billowing out over her shoulders, never still, seeming not to be blown by the wind, but to control the wind itself. And I knew something about the plume. Although my tired mind could not remember what it was I knew. And I tried to look into her eyes, but she was looking beyond me. And in my dream, I turned. And I knew she was looking at John Shamus. And on his face was a look of ineffable adoration. And when I turned to gaze at her again, the same look of love was in her eyes. And the veil, the plume whipped around, and I felt it brush my face like an icy lash. And it reached out and encircled John Chandos, and I awoke. And when John Chandos awoke, he spoke of a dream he had had.
The most amazing dream, old boy. Dreamed of the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Posed like a bride, had a great white veil, blowing in the wind, smiled at me. Most real dream I ever had. She was barefooted in all this cold, and the veil wrapped it around me. Must be going, mustn't I?
And he crawled out of the tent into the clear, cold dawn of the high altitudes. And in a moment, I heard him calling.
Brent! Brent, old boy! Brent, I say, come out! What's up? Come out! I found something!
I crawled out with great effort to find him on his knees at the side of the tent, staring at something in the hard-packed snow.
What is it?
I asked. He pointed.
Look! There!
And I looked. There in the snow were a woman's footprints. A woman's bare footprints in the age-old snow where no human being had ever been before. On my knees, I examined them carefully. A woman had stood there for a long time and then turned away. And the footprints in the snow led upwards. I lifted my head and looked up at the top of the mountain, still far above us in the rays of the first sun. And the veil, the plume of Everest, fluttered coldly against the dark blue of the sky.
You know it wasn't superstition. You saw the footprints. You saw how easy it was to follow them this morning. You know we climbed three times as far today as we ever climbed before. She's leading us. She wants us to come on up to her. Do you remember the night we started? When I spoke about going to meet my bride? Do you remember, Brent?
Yes. I remember.
I've not taken the leave of my senses, have I, Brent?
Not unless I have to.
My name is John Chandler. My family's coat of arms is Argent et Pile Gules. The days of the week are Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday,
Saturday,
Sunday. Is that right?
That's right.
And we did see the footprints.
Yes. We saw them.
Are you afraid, Hugh?
Afraid?
Yes.
No. I'm not afraid. Not for me.
What then?
I had the dream too.
Why did you say you're not afraid for yourself? Because in the dream, she chose you.
Yes.
I know that. You're not afraid? Why should I be afraid of my bride?
And then we slept again. And in the morning we went higher. The way was more difficult for me, but Chandler seemed to find it almost easy. We were on the very ledge from which Lee Mallory and Irvine disappeared in the folds of the plume. I recognized it dimly from the photographs and motion pictures that Captain Noel had made years before, as the two men slowly made their way along the rock wall not 2,000 feet from the summit. That scene will never leave my mind. And I knew we were almost in the exact spot where they had been snatched away. At any second, I thought, the cold caress of the veil, the plume, would fall on us. And then, the silences returned. I was seized with a desperate desire to turn back, but Chandos was marching on ahead easily, while I made most heavy going of it. We were roped together, and there was nothing to do but follow. I stumbled more and more frequently. And at last, I could go no farther. I sank down in the snow, close beside the wall with a sheer precipice at my elbow. And Chandos came back to me, having felt the pull of the rope at his waist.
Not much further, you.
I can't make it.
Well, higher than any man has ever been before. Look up.
I looked up. It was scarcely 500 feet to go. My tired eyes told me.
Scarcely 500 feet.
I can't. Go on without me.
No, I won't.
I can't go any farther.
Tomorrow, then?
No.
Well, what will we do?
I'm going back.
You can't do that, you.
Yes.
Well, I'll go back down with you. But let me go on ahead for just a moment. We're so close now. Let me see if I can go on up to the top by myself. And if I can, I will. Then I'll come back and we'll both go back down. Will you let me do that?
If you like.
Easy. You can go on up, too. It's a pity to be this far. Then turn back.
Do what you like.
You'll stay right here.
I'll stay here.
Well, hurry, old boy. Eat a bit of chocolate.
Why do you have to go and leave me?
Got to see if somebody's there, old boy.
I was already falling into a half stupor as he turned and went up the ledge. And for a little while I slept, I think, alone on a 16-inch ledge 5 miles above the ground. And I remembered confused dreams of a beautiful bride with a veil of sparkling ice crystals. And there was strange music in my ears. And presently, the sound of John Chandler's voice in disappointment.
Come on, old chap. We're going back down.
Down?
There's no way to the top.
But what do you mean?
There's an absolutely unclimbable wall. Just around that corner.
No way?
No way. No way at all. The rock face leans outward. I looked at it from every angle. There's just no way. So, come on.
Captain Noel,
And as he lifted me to my feet, there was the softest little sound as of something dropping into the snow beside us. I leaned against the wall as Chandos bent and picked it up. He looked at it very curiously for a long moment. And finally I mumbled, "What is it?" And he stretched out his hand to me. And in it was a full-blown, green-stemmed white rose. And when I took it from him, the frozen thing shattered into a million glittering fragments. And I looked at John Chandler's face, and it was transfigured with a joy and a hope such as I have never seen in any man. My gaze went on beyond him, upward, upward. And against the darkening sky, the great veil that streamed from the mountaintop slowly wheeled around and down toward us. And it seemed not like a whip to lash us to an icy death, but like the compassionate arms of a beloved woman stretched out to her lover. And then as its coldness enveloped us, I heard the beginning of an avalanche's roar above me and the sound of great bursts of triumphant music. Snow 100 feet above our last camp, and by turning my head I could see a tiny thread of smoke rising from the tent. And I rose slowly and looked upward. The plume of Everest was still blowing wide and free from the summit. And with an effort I found my binoculars and focused them on the topmost peak. Snow and ice and barrenness. Snow and ice and barrenness, and a man and a woman. A man in mountain climber's dress, a woman in a bride's flowing white gown and a veil floating from her hair. A veil that dissolved into the great streaming banner of ice crystals flung across the sky above the roof of the world.
Quiet, please, for tonight was called How Beautiful Upon the Mountain. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper. The man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell.
And John Chandos was played by Roy Irving, late of the Dublin Gate Theater. Music was played by Albert Berman, as usual, who also composes the special music heard on Quiet, Please. Now, for a word about next week's Quiet, Please, and his usual little insertion, my good friend, Willis Cooper.
The two principal characters in tonight's Quiet, Please are, of course, fictitious and sprang to mature life from the keyboard of my typewriter, so don't think they're anybody you ever knew. They aren't. Quiet, Please for next week will be called There Are Shadows There.
Arr, there'll be shadows. Arr.
And so, until next week at this same time, and there are shadows here, I am quietly yours, Ernest Chappell.
Ernie, baby.
Ask yourself this question. Do I practice prejudice in any way? You know, your answer is very important. Because after all, you simply can't hold a grudge against any of your fellow Americans and be a good American yourself. In this country today, the forces of bigotry and intolerance are definitely at work, undermining the principles of our freedom and equality upon which this nation was founded. If you help these forces of group hatred, you enlist yourself on their side and against America itself. You also do help these forces every time you speak out against your neighbor, because he attends a different church or if he had ancestors of a different religion. Remember, your personal behavior can encourage respect for other races, tolerance for other religions, so don't betray this country by spreading a doctrine of hate and prejudice against fellow Americans. Do your part to make freedom a living reality. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
I don't care what he says. I am not going to like Lima. Do not, will not. Fight a Lima bean.
Remember when yeah, remember when Eddie Albert used to fall into some type of rhetoric like that, and they would have like the Star Spangled Banner behind them? All American, we got it.
Well, I personally think it should be American to be acceptance, or whatever. I can't even speech right.
What?
Show acceptance for people who what be different than when you are.
That's close enough, Jeff.
But diversity is fine. But I'm still not going to eat kale. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it.
I am not going to have lima beans. Same.
Well, there you go. See, we are prejudiced. There are certain vegetables that we just
I have no lima bean prejudice myself.
How about an incredibly hot jalapeno pepper? A little bit there, maybe?
Well, I'm maybe a little bit there, yeah. And definitely against broccoli.
Wait a minute now. Okay. Broccoli is cool, man. Broccoli is cool.
Well, broccoli is cool to you, but not to Dave. I don't have a problem with broccoli. This isn't a broccoli intervention.
Perhaps it should be.
Dave, you and I need to team up against Dale on this lima bean campaign he's on.
Sorry. I'm not. A lima bean intervention. I just don't like lima beans. I don't like them. Don't like lima beans. Erie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story.
Due to gravity and lack of eternity on Earth, what goes up eventually has to come down.
That went down. Hey, you know, I did want to make a comment to good old Bob, and Gar has talked about this from time to time. I did not have time to get in there. I just had time to split up. I didn't have time to clean up. The first half was a half that I cleaned up. The second half was the half that basically I had to run off the original recording. I just split it up and sent it up to the line. So I apologize for not having the time to clean that half up correctly, since I didn't fix the second half correctly the first time.
Dave, I apologize to you because I could have picked up some of the slack on that, and I could have edited that, and gotten rid of all those problems.
Go ahead. No, because I had cleaned up and edited the whole thing, but I saved the second part the same as the first part, so that way, I had to use what I had, unfortunately. So I do apologize for that, folks. I will do better. I promise.
And like I said, unfortunately, I wasn't really on task on this, but this Erie House is a group effort, so
And what other groups do we have coming in for the show tonight, Dale? As we keep pushing along.
Next in our group of mountain songs is a story called The Mountain from a classic, Suspense.
A story calculated to keep you in suspense.
Do we have any
or suspenders? One of the
performers of note or production people?
Was
that
John
on this one?
Was it John Hudiak? Isn't that who's in this one, Gar? I believe.
Yeah, it's John Hudiak and Ernest Borgnine doing pantomime.
And Ernest Borgnine, but Ernest Borgnine was as the mountain. That's the thing.
As the mountain. He's the mountain,
as
and
the mountain.
He does pantomime.
And yeah, it was originally broadcast. It was originally broadcast. A long time ago.
Friday. March
13th, 1953.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Autolite and its 98,000 dealers bring you Mr. John
Friday.
Tonight's presentation of Suspense. Autolite presents a story about heroism as we document the attempt of three brave men to conquer the mountain. Our star, Mr. John Hodiak.
Hello. Bottom of the evening to you.
You mean top of the evening, don't you, Mr. McSorley?
No, bottom. My spirits are low as the water in my car's battery.
Oh, you mean it's dry?
Dry as an Irishman's wit.
Well, now, it's an Autolite Stay Full battery you're needing. That's the famous battery that needs water on use.
You mean that long life battery, Harlow?
Tis one and the same. Fiberglass mats surround every positive plate to reduce shedding and flaking and give the Autolite Stay Full longer life, as proved by tests conducted according to accepted life cycle standards.
And where can I be getting this marvelous marvel?
Why, from your nearest Autolite battery dealer, the man who services all makes of batteries. To quickly locate him, just phone Western Union by number and ask for Operator 25.
I'll tell you where to get an Autolite Stay Full, the battery that needs water only three times a year in normal car use.
And remember, from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
And now, Autolite presents The Mountain, starring Mr. John Hodiak, hoping once again to keep you in suspense. We made the fourth camp on the East Glacier, 22,000 feet above sea level. In that cold, thin air, we stood looking up. And in the great loneliness, we saw it. For a few seconds as the mist cleared, we saw it. The mountain, the peak towering over us, was beautiful and terrible. Then a swirling curtain moved around it, and it was gone again. There were six of us and the porters. Manton and Lees had been sent back to the third camp some 4,000 feet below. Both had been badly frostbitten. So then there were six of us left to make the attempt. Nobody had done it before. No one had ever reached the top of that tremendous windswept place. And now we were ready for the assault. That night we held our last meeting in the fourth camp. Gaines, Thomas, Feldman, Eldridge, Ferrucci, and myself.
That's the best way. The most practical. Three of us stay and three of us try to make it. We stand a better chance if we all do it together. What do you think, Bob?
I don't think so. Thomas is right. Three of us go and have to turn back. The other three will still be fresh. They can have a go.
That's right.
All right?
Sure.
Yes, of course.
Okay, two parties. Thomas, you'll head up the second. Stay at the camp. I'll lead the first one up.
Right.
Now, wait a minute. Don't we get a vote on this?
No, it's a waste of time. Start voting and we'll start arguing again. Those monsoons aren't going to hold off forever.
Take it easy, John.
Yes.
How's your leg, Harry?
Not bad. But I might hold you back. You better leave me down here.
All right. Ferrucci, you want me to go? Feel up to it?
Sure, you bet.
Gaines?
Okay.
You're not acclimated.
The cough? Nothing.
It'd get a lot worse higher. Better not.
Well, look, why not let me go with you and leave Harry in charge down here? That leg will be all right in a couple of days, don't you think, Harry?
It ought to be.
He hasn't had enough experience for a lead man.
Oh.
There's nothing wrong with me. Or is there? Well?
Well, I don't know, John. It's going to be pretty tough.
Well?
Well, listen, John.
You keep out of this, Thomas. What about it, Bob? I'm in good shape.
I guess so. Okay, you, Ferrucci, and myself. That'll be it. We'll start at daybreak. And that's the way we decided. There was no other possibility. It wasn't that we didn't like Eldridge. It was just that he was always flying off the handle, and because of that, he wasn't a good risk. Nerves don't go so well with mountain climbing. Not that mountain. Cold and dangerous. It's never gained peak, hidden in mist. Later that evening, Thomas and I were going over the equipment before turning in.
You know, someday they'll invent an oxygen tank that's light. Bet these things weigh over 30 pounds.
Yeah.
Bob.
Hmm.
About Eldridge.
What about him?
Do you think he ought to go?
It's the only way, I guess.
You're taking a big chance.
He'll be all right.
If we could only wait just a couple of days, Harry would be all right.
We're late now. If the monsoon starts, none of us will be able to do it.
That's the trouble. Well, you have Perucci along. He gets on pretty well with Eldridge. That'll help.
It'll be fine. We're all in good shape. I think we're going to make it.
In a way, I hope you don't. I'd like a crack at it myself. Oh, wouldn't that be something, the first man to get to the top?
You understand why I didn't take you, don't you?
Oh, of course. Wishful thinking, that's all. Well, you better turn in. I'll finish checking the stuff.
Okay, see you in the morning. On May the 18th, we started to climb the Northwest Ridge. We were at 23,000 feet. Each of us carried a 30-pound oxygen tank. Besides the equipment went higher, the wind started to take it out of us, and we felt the cold more.
They can, eh?
Yeah.
Why? Will you look at it up there? That's it? You almost feel like you could jump and touch the top.
Big jump, Perucci.
Yeah. What do you figure? About 3,500 feet more?
Something like that.
If the weather holds, we might make it by tomorrow.
That's what I thought.
Not a cloud in the sky. Oh, will you look at that thing? Boy, what can you say when you see a mountain like that?
Save your breath. We'll move in a few minutes. Then we hit patches of snow and the pace slowed down. We'd spelled each other as leader and it was my turn up ahead. Perucci was bringing up the rear when I heard him yell and felt that dreadful tug of the rope at the same time. Crumbling away from beneath Eldridge's feet. I saw it and I thought of a man I knew who slipped from an aerial ladder 100 feet up, and as he fell to the ground, his legs raced wildly, arms waving, trying to find the rungs to pull himself back up. And Eldridge was doing it now, his heels churning into the soft snow at the edge of the crevasse. Then he found solid ice.
Bob?
Yeah?
Can you pull me back? I can't get Perucci out from here. I'm afraid I'll go over too. I'm right on the edge.
Can he get a hold with his axe?
No. He's hanging free. The wall closed in. Hurry!
I'll try. You'll have to pull too, Bob. I can't do it alone. Too much weight.
I tell you, I can't. I'm afraid to move. I can feel it going under me, all around me.
There's solid ice a couple of feet back. I can grab it with my axe.
Don't let go. Don't let it go, Jack. Bob, I'll go over.
I won't. Just hang on. I knew that if I slipped when I reached behind me, it was the end. I looked at the figure of Eldridge below me, his body bent backwards away from the drop beneath him. I closed my eyes, reached behind with my axe, and dug into the ice.
I'm coming!
And as Eldridge shouted, I thought I heard another cry. And suddenly the rope's weight was lighter. I saw Eldridge fall, then get up on hands and knees and crawl away from the crevasse toward me. Norman! Where's Norman?
He's gone. He fell. He's gone.
He can't be. How?
I don't know. Perhaps the rope frayed on some ice at the edge. Suddenly it went slack. I heard him, Bob. I heard him.
Maybe it's not too deep. He might have fallen into a drift at the bottom. Stay here. I've got to see. I belayed the rope about the ice axe and paid out the rest of it as I slid down the slope to the crevasse. But when I looked over the edge, I knew. That dark blue, almost black emptiness below. I knew. There'd be no snowdrift for Norman Perucci's body, unless it was perhaps 10,000 feet below us. We bypassed that place, found a shelter from the wind, and pitched our tent. For a long time, neither one of us spoke. I think we were too exhausted to say anything. Exhausted and shocked. There were only two of us now.
I keep hearing him.
I know.
No, you don't. Not the way I do.
He's a nice kid.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem as cold without the wind.
How high do you think we are?
24,000.
I wonder, it's a little hard to breathe. Better use the oxygen.
No, not yet. We won't need it.
Yes, yes, we will. We'd better save it.
We're going down in the morning.
No.
We've got to. You and I couldn't make it up there alone. 2,500 feet to go, maybe more. No, we've got to go back. Let the others try.
Just because he's gone, is that why?
Look, I've done more climbing than you out here. What happened today is bad for the nerves. We couldn't make it. We'll go back. Try again later.
But the monsoons will be here later. We've got to do it now.
Thomas and the others can do it.
No. We'll keep going. I've got to. I'm not going back.
What's the matter with you? You're talking like a kid.
Look, I was the last one on your list when you got the party together, wasn't I?
Yes.
Why? Why was I last?
I don't know. Somebody had to be. It was you, that's all.
You're a liar. You didn't want me along. None of you did.
You're here, aren't you?
You know I'm afraid of climbing, don't you?
Isn't everybody? A little? Isn't that why we do it? Isn't that part of it?
No, I mean really scared. I'm really scared. You know that.
No, I don't.
Look, something happened when Noah... Something happened to me today. I've got to go on to the top now.
You think I'll call you a coward if we don't?
No.
All right, then, forget it. We'll try again. Maybe next year. You'll be along, too.
I'll do it alone, then. I'm going on alone. Now, if you want to come with me, all right. If not, it doesn't matter anyway. I'm going on. So long.
John! John!
He didn't stop. Just moved up the ice slab and around the hummock out of sight. I went back inside the tent to get my pack. I couldn't let him do it alone, and I was trapped into going with him. Then I saw that the fool hadn't even taken his rope. It was neatly coiled in a corner. I grabbed it up. And as I did so, I saw the end of it. The end which had broken when Peruzzi hung over the crevasse. The rope which Eldridge had said was parted by the ice. But there were no frayed ends. The break was clean. It had been cut through. And the oil of Eldridge's knife blade was still on it.
Is bringing you Mr. John Hodiak with Ben Wright as Eldridge in The Mountain. Tonight's presentation in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Oh, an Autolite there holds the battery for me. It's the finest fine battery I ever did see.
Ah, tis the truth, Mr. McSorley. And that famous Autolite staple needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use.
And hello, my boy, would you repeat about the glass of fiber?
A pleasure it is. Those fiberglass retaining mats surround every positive plate to reduce shedding and flaking and give the Autolite staple longer life as proved by tests conducted according to accepted life cycle standards. So, friends, visit your Autolite battery dealer. He services all makes of batteries, and he's got an Autolite staple for your car if a replacement is needed. To quickly locate your nearest Autolite battery dealer, call Western Union by number.
Ask for operator 25. I'll tell you where to get an Autolite staple, the battery that needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use.
And as they say on St. Patrick's Day,
from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
That's right. Keep watering that battery so it grows and grows and grows.
That's right. Because we all need a bigger battery.
We do have a whole lot of radio to go.
We do.
And with that said, let's wrap up Suspense, The Mountain.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage Mr. John Hodiak in Elliot Lewis's production of The Mountain. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
When Eldridge had thought that he was going over the crevasse, he'd cut the rope which had held Norman Peruzzi's body some 20 feet into the chasm. To save his own life, he'd done this. I pulled the coil through the straps of my pack and left the tent. Caught up with Eldridge about 100 feet higher. He was standing on a shallow ledge, catching his breath, and his head was tilted back, eyes fixed on that mountaintop,
the brain of the monster.
There's a nasty bit back there. I was cutting steps up the cliff. I nearly fell.
You didn't, though.
No, I didn't. I say, you're coming with me, eh?
I want to see that you get down alive. You forgot your rope. I found it in the tent.
I didn't think I'd need it.
You might. Here.
Thanks.
We better tie on together.
All right. Do you want to go first?
No. It's your party now. You lead.
All right.
He had a funny look on his face as we roped together. I think he must have known then that I'd found out what he'd done. He didn't say anything, though, but turned and began to move upwards. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, we were at about 25,000 feet. It was hard to breathe now, terribly hard. We decided to rest for a few minutes. I remembered looking down from the ridge, looking down into the incredible scene below. Then up, and the peak which loomed over us, clear against the sky, perhaps 1,500, perhaps 2,000 feet over us. I remembered Peruzzi's excitement as he'd seen it further down. And even then, I thought it could be beaten, that we might do it.
We'll use the oxygen from here as soon as we start again.
Can't do any more today.
Oh, yes. We can go higher.
Then what?
Then it gets dark, camp. Finish it tomorrow, if we don't today.
If a storm comes up, we'll be in trouble.
It won't. We're going to make it. I know we are.
Then what?
Well, it doesn't matter after that.
We'll have to go down to the others.
Yes, I suppose so.
We'll have to tell them about Norman.
Yes.
We going to tell the same story?
I think we will.
You know why I followed you? Why I came along?
Yes.
It's like that. Yes. You murdered a man, and that's all there is to it.
I was afraid. I knew if I went over, we'd all go. It was the only way.
If you'd waited, we could have got him out.
I didn't know it then. I felt myself going. I had to do it.
What's all this for? To wipe out the sin? Get to the peak and be a man again?
In a way, perhaps.
You won't be. You'll never be. When this gets out, and it's going to, there'll be no place for you to hide. No place to go.
Huh. We'd better get moving.
We began to use the oxygen sparingly and kept moving up slower and slower, our hearts pounding with the effort. 100 feet, 200, 3. I began to feel lightheaded. I couldn't. Not another step. I couldn't. Then it was 400 feet. Eldridge collapsed in front of me and lay in the fine snow, sobbing. We stop. Stop here.
We've got to go on.
No.
Go on.
And he sobbed like a child. His mind willed him to keep going, and his body wouldn't allow it. We lay there, using our precious oxygen, because I think had we not done so, we'd have died of fatigue. The wind had died down completely. And there was a silence so complete that you could almost imagine it bore a sound in itself. Deadening. Awful. We made camp and tried to sleep. We were too tired to think of food. With the night came a heavy mist. And it began to grow much colder. The morning of May 20th was gray, clouded. The peak of the mountain was shrouded, and I knew that it was going to snow. Directly ahead of us was an ice wall. There was no way around it. We had to climb almost vertically, cut our own steps with ice axe, one by one, and climb. This time I took the lead. And as I knotted the rope, Eldridge said,
"You don't trust me, do you? You're afraid if I'm leading a new fall. I'll cut the rope again."
"You might. Let's go." that point, we had ascended 25,400 feet. The ice wall would take us another 100 higher. The wind began to blow when we were halfway up. Two pathetic specks on a wall of the world. We'll move around to the right after this step. There's a bit of a ledge.
All right.
Okay. Come on. The ledge was at most 10 inches wide, narrowing down in places to no more than a toehold. I felt my way along until the ledge gave out. Then the hacking of steps began again. The wind tore at me, screamed, and like a great hand tried to sweep me off the wall. Once I looked down, and it was as though a white blanket were stretched out beneath. It was snow. I could see it billowing up and around, while above, the summit ignored everything beneath. The blizzard hit us as we reached the top of the ice wall. We found a little shelter in the lee of a pyramid-shaped summit and waited. And then the slope seemed to lurch. I had a split second to see the wave of snow pouring down on me. It was over. Done. The avalanche swept us down, smothering, killing. And I thought of the ice wall and the drop below. That's all I remember. I'd stopped falling. It was my first thought when I came to. I wasn't dead. I saw a pair of legs crouch next to me.
I didn't think you were going to make it.
Where'd I land?
Yeah. Hanging over the ice wall.
But you were behind me. You didn't go over.
No. Don't ask me why. It must be a corner of the avalanche that hit us. You ended up pulling me down. My axe caught in one of the steps and it held us both.
And you pulled me up.
Yeah, looks like it.
Thanks. How long have I been out?
Hour. A little more.
Blizzard's letting up.
Here. Now, do you feel like going on?
I think so.
All right.
You tell me something.
What?
Why did you pull me out of it? Why didn't you just let me go over the edge? Then you wouldn't have had me around to tell.
Look, I'm not a murderer, Bob. I cut Norman's rope because I was afraid. If I thought there was even a chance of us not falling, I wouldn't have done it, but I didn't know. Look, that doesn't excuse me. But it doesn't mean I'd kill you to get out of it.
Yeah?
I better save the talk. We'll need our breath. You want to lead, or shall I?
I'll do it. The storm had passed, and although we could see the cold sky again, the peak was still only occasionally visible through patches of mist. We went up, higher, higher. And then my oxygen tank went out, and we had to share Eldridge's. We'd nearly reached 26,000 feet. We could see the top. For a moment, it stood out clear. And it looked so easy. The last lap. But now we could only move a few steps at a time until we had to rest. And I couldn't get up again.
It looks pretty easy past that ridge.
Have to wait.
All right. Wait for me.
No.
Now go on.
No, together. Just wait. A couple of minutes.
It'll be getting dark. I'll come back for you.
No. Minutes.
Here. Yeah. You? You take the oxygen.
No.
I don't need...
No, John, no.
I won't need it. You wait here.
No.
I'll get down again.
Wait.
Look, I'm sorry. I was afraid. I'm still afraid. That's why I've got to do it. You understand? Sit on, Bob.
I didn't have the strength to stop him as he untied the rope which had held us together. Then he was gone. And after a while, I felt stronger. I sat up. I could see him. A dark blob against the mountain snow. Smaller. Smaller. And he was climbing upwards. He'd reached the final pinnacle and became a dot that was lost in the mist. I saw Eldridge once more. He couldn't have been more than 250 feet below the peak. For perhaps 10 seconds I saw him. And then he disappeared. I waited. Waited into the night. The next morning I began to look for him. But the oxygen was gone. I knew that if I had to climb another foot, I'd die. So I turned back. There was no wind anymore. It was almost warm. Somehow I got down. Down to the base camp. I told him the story. Almost the whole story, but not quite. I changed a rope which had been cut with a knife into a rope which had frayed and parted on the ice. I remember as we started down to the valley below, I turned and stood a minute, looking back, looking up. Then a cloud softly poured over the peak. And in a moment, the mountain was gone.
Suspense. Presented by Autolite, tonight's star, Mr. John Hodiak.
This is Harlow Wilcox again, speaking for Autolite, world's largest independent manufacturer of automotive electrical equipment. Autolite is proud to serve the greatest names in the industry. That's why, during these early months of 1953, the Autolite family joins again in saluting the leading car manufacturers who install Autolite products as original equipment. Our Autolite family is made up of the nearly 30,000 men and women in 28 great Autolite plants from coast to coast and in still other Autolite plants in many foreign countries. Our family also includes more than 18,000 people who have invested a portion of their savings in Autolite, as well as 98,000 Autolite distributors and dealers in the United States and thousands more in Canada and throughout the world. 3 weeks from now, as the climax of this year's Autolite Family Salute program, Autolite will present special programs on both radio and television direct from the Easter Parade of Stars Auto Show in New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. So don't miss this exciting suspense radio program originating from the Grand Ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria on Monday, April 6th.
Next week, a story in the classic tradition of suspense, as we present a new version of Charles Dickens' terrifying short story, The Signalman. Our star, the first lady of suspense, Miss Agnes Moorhead. That's next week on Suspense. The Mountain was written for Suspense by Anthony Ellis. The program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis, with music composed by Lucian Morowick and conducted by Lud Gluskin. In tonight's play, Ben Wright was heard as Eldridge. Featured in the cast were Joseph Kearns, John Fraser, Paul Frees, and James McCallion.
John Hodiak may soon be seen in the Columbia Pictures production Mission Over Korea.
And remember, next week, Miss Agnes Moorhead in Charles Dickens' The Signalman.
Tomorrow is an important day, not only to the wearers of the green, but also to the campfire girls. March 17th marks the 43rd anniversary of this organization dedicated to teaching American girls how to become good citizens of the future. Autolite congratulates the campfire girls and their inspired leaders.
Erie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story. Thank you.
Two things you don't need when mountain climbing. Ego and id.
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 Id was the monster in Forbidden Planet. Yep. And
or that cartoon strip, The Wizard of Id. Man, that was so funny.
Funny stuff. It was.
Funny stuff.
If we had time, we'd talk more about that, but we got to get right to the Goon Show. This is the greatest mountain in the world.
That's what it is.
Yep. And do we have an original broadcast date on this bad boy?
Monday, March 1st, 1954. Blah, blah.
For anyone, yes, it's song time with Webster Swamp Fuel.
Only a
once again, welcome to your song break. Half an hour of glorious musical boredom with songs that your mother loved and everyone else hated.
Thank you, Dennis Main. Tonight I am including in my repertoire Schubert's Violin Sonata, guest soloist Billy Hugh Scott. And now, request spot. My first request comes from Jack Blonger, a two-headed Mongolian criminal tram driver who is under treatment for the dreaded emulsion of the legs and the green lurgy. Cheer up, Jack. I'm all right. And here is your song, and it's I'm alone to be my own, alone, my love, to find your caressing song divine, and you are mine. I wonder how my love...
We regret to announce the sudden death of the well-known BBC tenor, Webster Smogpule. The program and the death were recorded. The next program follows in 1 second.
Here is the next program. With Patrick Sellers, Isaac Thecombe, and Tom Milligan, we present
the greatest mountain in the world, or... I knew Fred Kroot, or...
the greatest mountain in the world.
This story opens in the basement of a disused fish squirting factory. There, during a meeting being held by the Royal Geographical and Archaeological Society, a member is concluding his speech.
And he's got one digging, one covering up, and one looking for fresh places. And that's how King Tutankhamun's carbon tomb was discovered. And thank you.
Thank you, Sir Martin McWheeler.
I don't wish to know that.
And now, please, silence for the right and left, Honorable Sir Harry Teagle. President of the Young Tiddle-Eyed Pearl. Honorary parole prisoner and twice winner of the Dartmoor Escape Medal.
Thank you, gentlemen. Members, in view of Sir Edmund Hillary and Tiger Tenzing's great achievement last year, I have decided to go one better. I intend to climb the highest mountain in the world.
But it's already been climbed.
You're thinking of the one Hillary and Tenzing climbed. Well, now, I have news for you. Ooh. I have discovered a higher one.
What is its name?
Well, I can't keep this mountain a secret forever. It's bound to leak out eventually. I'll tell, and you're the first men to hear it. It's called Mount Everest.
Pardon. Pardon, sir, but the mountain has already been climbed. Hooray.
Climbed? Climbed by whom?
Hillary and Tenzing. Hooray.
My goodness. My.
So, they've climbed Mount Everest as well. What a dirty trick. Never mind. I'll not be defeated by this dishonored stratagem. I will find a higher mountain.
And where are we going to find this higher mountain?
Well,
Boss.
What, Ellington?
Why don't we build a higher mountain?
Build our own mountain?
Yeah.
What rubbish? Get out! Has he gone?
Yes.
Good. Gentlemen, I have a brilliant idea. Why don't we build our own mountain?
Brother, buddy. Yeah, buddy.
Thank you, buddy.
Okay, buddy.
Yes. Yes. Now, where will we build this mountain? Yes, Mr. Crumb?
I think we should build it in Hyde Park.
Why Hyde Park?
Well, it's handy for the buses and shops.
Hyde Park. Any objection?
Oh, yes. If we build this mountain on England, England would sink under the weight.
Sink? In that case, this mountain would be invaluable. People could climb up the sides and save themselves from drowning.
Muzzy, you're right. Hurry and build it before we all drown.
Splendid. Who will second Mr. Crumb's idea?
I will.
Anyone else?
Yes, me.
Excellent. Mr. Crumb, your idea has won support.
I thank them. I walk in the shadows.
Yes, I can see that. On Monday, then, we start cleaning Hyde Park. Cleaning that, we'll start on Monday. If not, in Hyde Park on Monday. Meeting adjourned.
Work began, and a great area in the park was cleared. The method was very simple. One digging, one filling in, and one looking for fresh places.
Foreman Spruntley! Glad to hear it. Now, did you drain the water from the Serpentine?
And we filled it in with solid concrete.
Concrete. Good. That's very good.
What a beautiful morning. Scream my love. And would your question set me burning? Oh, what a beautiful morning.
Eccles.
Yo?
What are you doing?
Having a good time.
Having a good time? How'd you get that lump on your head?
I just dived in the Serpentine.
Dived in? Did you know it was solid concrete?
No, but I know now. In any case, I wouldn't dare dive in a pool with water in it.
Why not?
Oh, can't swim.
Look what I've got in this little box.
Oh, it's a little lump.
Yes, a lump. I put it on the ground. There. Now, I'm going to make a mountain out of that.
What is it?
A mountain.
Anyone about here?
Yes, us.
What are you three laying down for?
A very good reason.
What's that?
You just ran over us.
Are you Mr. Crumb?
Only just.
Well, this parcel on my lorry is for you.
Oh, that'll be the mole for my molehill. Come on, help me lift it down.
Ooh. Got the old belt on. Good luck.
Good grief, it weighs a ton. Now let's get the string cut. Eccles the scissors.
Okay, here we go. A bit there, one there. How's that?
Very good. But I didn't want a haircut.
Here he is. The mole.
Oh, yeah, look at him. He must be hungry.
Yes. Here, boy. Here's a nice worm for you.
Thanks. Any more?
You idiot, Eccles. That was for the mole, you... I say, are you sure he's a mole?
Of course he's a mole. Look, here's the letter. With love to our dear British friends from your pals the Egyptians. There. If you don't believe me, read the label round its neck as proof.
All right. Here. It says L-I-O-N. L-I-O-N? Mole? L-I-O...
Well, what does it say?
Lion! It's a lion!
you silly man, you. Ellington, do you think it's a lion?
Yes!
Nice pussy. Pussy, pussy, pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy. Here, pussy. Eat this. It's all for you.
Put me down.
The greatest mountain in the world, end of part one. Ices, chocolates, and Max Galbraith.
Greatest Mountain in the World, Part 2. Now read on.
Having escaped from the lion, work went ahead on building the mountain. Then, when it had reached a height of 10,000 feet, disaster. At midnight, Crun was awakened.
Pardon me, is this your mountain, sir?
Yes, I am part owner of it.
I'd love to come down, you know.
What?
I'd love to come down. It'll have to be dismantled.
But what? Who are you?
Sex, male, name, Bog F. Superintendent, Ministry of Works and Housing. Section 9. No mountain weighing more than 8 pounds, 10 ounces, and measuring more than 20 feet, may be built within a radius of Nelson's Column.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'll just put these little sticks at the base of the mountain and light the fuses. Aye.
Oh. Is that all?
Yes, that's all, thank you. Well, I better be going now.
Good night, and a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, and a Happy New Year to you.
What a nice fellow. Now, what are these two red sticks he's stuck in here? Huh? There's writing on them. Dynamite!
Hello? Hello. Did I hear someone calling? Something burning out here. Oh, what a bit of luck. Two big cigars and a boat lit. Let me see. What brand are they now? TNT brand. Must be a new make. I'll take a puff on one. Strong. I'd better nip the other one out and save it for later.
The mountain's all gone. Oh, Ellington.
I ain't Ellington.
Huh? Oh, no, you're not. Yours wipes off.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Eccles. Your Eccles.
Yeah, oh, pleased to meet you, Eccles. Pleased to meet you.
But the mountain's blown to pieces.
Oh.
What's happened? Where's my mountain?
Gone destroyed. Smashed to pieces by the Ministry of Works.
We'll call an immediate meeting of the Royal Alpine Society.
Yep, we'll get to that meeting in just a little bit, because we got very little time to wrap things up here at Erie House. This is fun. You can clearly see the influence on other British comics. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's just so zany and out there and wild, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, they throw it on a molehill, and it becomes a mountain. You know, I love that.
That was a great line. Let's wrap up. Gar, shall we? Let's wrap up. The greatest mountain in the world. The Goon Show.
Yes.
Yes.
Hey, middle afternoon, you know. Half most of the time, half the people have been heard of. I have never lived on me I have never lived on me at all. I'm never,
Well, gentlemen, Lord Elphers had made it quite clear. We have no option. We have to start building another mountain in another country. I therefore call upon Major Badnock for advice.
And other disgusting noises. Gentlemen, I have the answer to this problem.
Bravo, buddy.
Silence, Miss Bannister, or I'll muggle your crampons with me grit cup. Now to biz. Mount Everest, it's 5 miles high, isn't it? Yes?
Yes.
But it measures 12 miles across the bottom.
Well?
Well, all we need to do is to tip Mount Everest on its side, and we'll have a mountain 12 miles high.
How do you intend tipping Mount Everest on its side?
Well, isn't it obvious?
No.
Then I have another idea. Why don't we saw the top off Everest, insert a portion of some other mountain underneath, thus raising Everest another 100 feet?
No. That would be cheating and against the international alpine laws.
Gentlemen.
Oh, might I interpose? Thank you. I know of a mountain that is higher than Mount Everest. Ooh.
Well said, Eccles.
Thank you. This mountain is 33,000 feet high.
And its name?
Fred. Mount Fred. There is, however, one snag. It is under the sea, 300 Kilgoorlie fathoms down.
Well, it's worth a try. Hands up those in favor. Well, now, gentlemen, it is decided we sail on an expedition ship to locate the sunken mountain. Ellington?
Yes, dear boy.
Clear the deck.
At your leisure. A girl in Kalamazoo. I don't want a booze, but I know she's a toast. A Kalamazoo, zoo. Years have gone by, my, how she grew. I like her looks when she carried my books in Kalamazoo, zoo. I'm gonna send a wire, hop aboard a flyer, leaving today. Am I dreaming? I can hear her screaming. Hiya, Mr. Jackson. Everything's okay. A-L-A-M-O-Z-O. Oh, what a girl. A real pipperoo. I'll make my bid for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to. I'm gonna meet you, gonna see that sweetest gal in Kalamazoo. Mash beans on toast.
screaming, hiya, Mr. Jackson, everything's okay, A-L-A-M-O-Z-O. Oh, what a girl, she's a real pipperoo. I'll make my bid for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to. I'm going to Michigan to see that sweetest gal. I'm going to see my beautiful chick. All aboard, all aboard, all aboard, all aboard. I'm going to see that sweetest gal in Kalamazoo.
Mighty Mountain, Part 3. Read on.
We fitted out a magnificent expedition vessel. To make the ship safe, we sent it by boat. And soon we hove to above the mighty Mount Fred.
Lower the anchor.
Okay.
Shouldn't it have had a chain attached to it?
Oh, yeah. But it couldn't have been a very good anchor.
Why not?
It sank, didn't it?
Ah, Major, sir. Your secret deep-sea observation bathysphere, the X-9, is ready to be lowered over the side.
Well, I'm afraid we can't use it. You see, there's a slight technical fault.
What's that?
The whole thing's useless. However, I found another method of making forced meatballs.
Forced meatballs?
Yes.
Major Bloodnock, we've not come 6,000 miles out here with all this ultra-modern submarine equipment and diving apparatus equipped for steep-sea mountain climbing to make forced meatballs?
And why not?
Because we've come to climb the highest undersea mountain in the world.
Slice me dunger and hell me iron, Satis. What blasted idiot thought of that?
You did, sir.
What a brilliant idea.
May I interrupt you for a second?
Yes, what do you want?
Nothing. I just want to interrupt.
Get out of here, you naughty little boy, you. Oh, you
Major.
Naughty little thing.
Mage.
What?
According to our calculations, we're almost above Mount Fred.
Then, action! Men, to climb this underwater giant, we shall need the following. Alpenstocks, skis, rope, crampons, crevices, grappling irons, and tents.
Tents? But this climb is underwater.
Pardon me, you're right. Include umbrellas, raincoats, and Miss Myrtle Penelope Dimple.
What's she for?
I like the woman.
How are we going to carry all the heavy equipment?
Camels.
Camels? Camels live underwater? That's mad.
Of course, only mad camels could live underwater. We're in condition tonight. Do you think I'm crazy?
Yes.
What a splendid judge of character this fellow is. Now, what next? Ah, yes. Provisions. Most important. Paraffin cookers. For cooking paraffin.
You can't cook underwater.
Of course not. We shall surface for all meals, you understand. And now, how far is it to the base of the mountain? Get ready, all you climbers.
How do you intend getting down to the mountain?
Quite simple. One digging, one filling in, and one... I mean my famous fireman system. We lower a greasy pole over the ship's side, and we all slide down to the mountaintop and plant the British flag.
No. That will never do.
What?
That would be a foul. You can't climb down to get to the top of a mountain. The International Alpine Club state categorically that all mountains must be climbed up to get to the top.
Flood me cistern with galloping crabs. You mean we've got to climb to the bottom and then climb up again?
Yes.
Thud. How far is it to the very bottom?
Approximately 3 miles. To be exact, 3 miles.
Much too far to walk. Everybody in the car, we'll drive down. Ellington, away we go.
Right.
To enable the story of the underwater epic to be continued, the BBC have installed microphones at the base camp of Mount Fred, on the North Col, and at the summit. Now, read on.
Stop the car! We're lost. Lord Seagram, ask a native where we are.
Right, sir. I'll knock on this oyster.
Yes?
Oh. Is
but I'm her mother.
Of course, you must be mother of pearl. Mother of pearl.
Yes, that's right. Now, what do you want, buddy?
Could you direct me to Mount Fred?
I'm a stranger down here, buddy.
You'll regret this, buddy. Oh. You can't trifle with the British Empire, buddy.
Beat it, buddy.
Here, buddy. You funny-dunny, buddy.
Come on, Deacon. Stop arguing. Don't argue. Get in. Drive on, Ray.
Okay.
Hey, oh, look what I met, an octopus.
But don't stop to shake hands. We'll be here all day. Drive on, Ray.
Okay, again.
He should have waited for us.
Yes, now we're hopelessly lost.
Lost? Rubbish. I know exactly where we are.
Where?
Here.
I do believe you're right. I do believe so. Nevertheless, someone must search us and see where we are. Now, let me see, who shall it be? Blue Bottle!
I heard you call me, my captain. I heard you call me. England expects. Six hand up jumper in Lord Nelson pose. Move the stage, way.
Blue Bottle, I want you to get to the surface.
The surface, it shall be. I shall surface. Quickly puts on Elsie C. men's night only bathing drawers. I am ready, Captain. Pray tell me, how do I get to the surface?
Just grab the horns of the submerged mine.
Oh, jolly good. Here. Do not mines go off, bang?
Of course not. Do your duty, Blue Bottle.
I knew it was safe for me to do my duty, Blue Bottle. Move forward over to mine. Grab hold of horns. Very gently. Aye. It is safe. I did not believe you at first, but now I know that...
Hello?
You run and swine, you! you have deaded me again. Oh, I die in my prime. Farewell, okay. Push his button, B. Gets money back. Exits to Nappy 14.
I've deaded him.
Ooh.
I'll have to tell his mother.
Yeah, that'll cheer her up, yeah.
Lord Seagun.
Who, oh, it's Madeline Munro.
Ooh, here. Ooh.
Take your hands away from me, Echo.
Mr. Crun, how can I mistake you for Madeline Munro?
I've got air bubbles in the seat of my trousers.
I see.
Now, I've come down to tell you that the explosion has blown Mount Fred to bits.
What? Oh, curse. The only mountain taller than Everest and we Georgie Wood. Oh, that's ruined our chances.
Oh, never mind. Never mind. Here. Oh, study. Have a cigar.
Thanks.
It's one I got from that Ministry of Works fellow.
Hmm. Strong, aren't they?
Yeah.
We regret to announce the death of Lord Seagun, Mr. Crun, and Eccles. The program was recorded. Good night.
Yep. Good night, folks. Have a good time.
You're supposed to be deaded.
No, I'm not deaded.
Hurry up and be deaded, then you can go home for tea.
Yeah, come on, Eccles, be deaded.
No, I'm not going to be deaded.
You are deaded. We're all deaded.
I'm not deaded.
That was The Goon Show, a recorded program featuring Peter Sellers, Harry Seacombe, and Spike Milligan with the Rail Engine Quartet and Max Geldray. The orchestra was conducted by Wally Stott, script by Spike Milligan, announcer Wallace Greenslade, the program produced by Peter Eaton. It is now proven that the cast were all deaded. The London Palladium is now appearing in Argyle Street. Argyle Street is also appearing there. Philip Harbin has not been properly deaded, neither has Kay Hammond. Now read on. We'll be right back.
There you go with the Goon Show, and that kind of wraps it up for us here tonight on Erie House. Tomorrow, 6:30 Eastern, CBS Radio Mystery Theater, Dead Man's Mountain. That's our last mountain to climb for the weekend. Dead Man's Mountain tomorrow, CBS Radio Mystery Theater. That's going to end, about 8 o'clock. Wonder what one might do at that time.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we find out that the inventor of the wind chill factor died recently. He was 82, but he felt like he was 64. And
that would.
And Horrible Horror stars Garth Gould. Kicks off at 8 p.m. on Twitches.
Yep.
Okay. I'll be there. You guys be there, too.
Any weirdness sightings coming soon?
Just my regular outlets right now. So answers, I don't think so on the thing, except for, the Uncle Pete's Roku channel, the Betamax TV. We've got over a dozen shows right there for you.
There's a couple of Roku channels I can find you, Dave. And also you can find a lot of his skits up on the YouTubes. They keep popping up on my feed for some reason. Wonder why.
I'm sorry.
Not to worry.
I posted my little Cookie Monster skit up on YouTube this week.
Cool.
Yep, that's good.
Great. Good man.
Totally edited. Yep.
Totally.
And
totally
in between all of that, come back here, go into the archives, start from the first show, and catch up. You only got 600 and some odd shows to go. So
that's right.
And don't forget to join us tomorrow, 6:30 Eastern, for more fun. We'll see you then. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Yeah?
This thing won't scroll fast enough.
Castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And him.
When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
Dig it.
Ow. Very nice, Dave. You covered for me.
I thought I was going to be a couple seconds left.
Needed a little.
So what do you think? Shall we insert a Goon Show once in a while?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, my gosh, that was great stuff. That was awesome. More goons.
We had heard Quiet Please before. One of the episodes was the foilable floor, right?
Yeah, the thing on the foilable board, yeah.
Yeah, that thing up there. Yeah.
We've shared a couple of these, yeah. Rain on a New Year's Eve and The Good Ghost. There's quite a few of these that we have shared. I really like the way they come out. And yes, what's funny is there was a mysterious traveler, the one about the haunted trailer. It sounded so much like set up like a Quiet Please. I was waiting for Ernest Chappell to show up.
And I just kept wanting to say Hoodiak, Hoodiak, over and over. It's a fun name to say.
I know.
Hoodiak.
Hoodiak.
Or is it Hodiak?
Hoodiak.
They're both Hodiak. Fun.
That's right.
It's a fun name.
Tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. Oh, it's too late for that. It's already over.
Yep. Too late to cancel if we completed the show.
Oh, well, you can't lose them all.
Damn it.
Yeah,
you
well,
can,
try,
but you
yeah.
should keep your receipts. That's the other
yeah, that's true, because, you lose enough, you can deduct it from your taxes. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
As a business expense, of course. As a business expense.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm supporting Three Cocktails waitresses on these. Oh, well.
I don't know, but after messing up my arm, I'm putting that dog on a diet. He's too big.
Well, a suggestion I could have for that would be instead of instead of having him on your arm, attach his harness to your belt.
Oh, yeah, that'll be good. There go my pants down the street. No one wants to see that.
Well, that would be a funny video as long as we don't catch you in after it. You know, there's a dog running down with a lance connected, yeah.
And then the last part of this is more training with your dog, because your dog should never pull you, ever.
Yeah, I know. He's a little wild.
If he's pulling you, that means he feels like he's in more control than you are. That's not good. Especially if you've got a big hound.
That would mean the dog would be better trained than Dale is.
He is.
Well, right now the dog is trained Dale.
The dog has to go outside.
Yeah. You can't make it that far, huh?
Right.
Some days.
But yeah, you need to flip that. I had a big dog. I had an 80-pound dog here, and he was trained like, okay, we're going for a walk. Don't pull. You're either at my knee or behind me, but you're not in front of me. And it's a hard thing to, you know, to sit there and go, you can't do that. But you have to do that little dominance thing. And once it's done, it's done. It's forever. You don't have to worry about it. But you do have to get to that point where your doggy recognizes you're in control, not the other way around.
He lost his mind. He saw kids. He went crazy. He loves kids.
Well, there's a way to calm him down on that too. it moves through and he calms down. But you can't, you know, you can't.
Oh no,
you can't.
Kids don't excite me. Believe me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no. It's the dog. The dog's excitement, and maybe there was some apprehension or something going on, but it's something
not at all.
That triggered the dog to go.
Nah, collies are known to be very fond of kids. He's not crazy. We got rid of that nipping business. He had that collie herding nipping thing going on when he was little. We put an end to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah. No, he was very, very gentle. He just forgets he's a big bounding oaf, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want him knocking a little kid over, so I just have to restrain him, and he pulled kind of hard.
Well, yeah, if that's going on, then again.
Yeah, well.
There's a learning moment in that, more for you than the dog. Or maybe both.
Maybe.
But yeah, that was a difficult thing. I felt like, you know, just let him be. And it's like, no, he really needs to respect boundaries. Your knee is a boundary. He cannot go beyond your knee when you're walking. That's where they have to stay, there or behind you.
Or anything else with my knee.
Well, if he's romancing your knee, then it's a whole nother training problem.
No. No, he has not. Okay. No. He's been altered. In fact, that was part of the deal. They didn't want us breeding him, so they asked us to alter him.
Well, see, that romancing your chin is more of a
I don't like calling it fixed
dominant thing.
I don't like calling it having him fixed because, like, they take something that works.
He wasn't broken.
Was he broken?
Yeah.
No,
they took something that works, and then they make it not work. That ain't fixing a thing.
Right. Well,
it fixes one thing, but only one thing.
He's not romantic at all.
Right. Well, there you go. Well, that's a good thing. I took some cues because I had not had a dog as an adult in a long time, and so I went out there and found a few tricks and tips for training a dog so that everything's fine and good. The love is there. Everything is fine. But,
yeah,
you know, if you're out and about, you are in control, not the other way around.
Oh, yeah. He knows who's in. He knows who the boss is, but.
Yeah, but
he,
it's him, right?
Huh?
Yeah, but he pulled your
it's
arm
him,
out
though.
Of socket.
It's like a cat. Cat their boss, you know, and they let you know.
Yeah. Well, I had a cat trained so it would walk on a leash with me. I'd go out and take a walk, and the cat would be with me on a leash. Yeah. You can train any animal, if you do it correctly, can be, you know, shown new behaviors.
Well, collies, you need
it's
to
a
use
lot of fun.
A very, collies, you have to use a gentle hand. They do not respond to rough or force at all.
Oh, no, it's not force. It's repetition, reinforcement. But the dog I had was a Shar Pei and a Chow. And if you want to talk about a breed that could be stubborn, good grief.
I thought a Shar Pei was a hat.
It's a chapeau.
No, that's a fedora.
Oh, chapeau. Okay.
Fedora.
Shar Pei is a Chinese wrinkle dog. And a Chow is also an Asian dog. And this was a combination of the two. Mixed with
Chow
an Australian wire-haired terrier.
I thought Chow was dinner time.
No, that's a different thing.
Aren't Chows the ones with the purple tongue?
Yes. Yeah, and so my dog had parts of his tongue were purple, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shar Pei as well can have a purple tongue. It's a very, I don't know, it's an odd breed. He is an unusual, a loving, most lovable guy I've run across. Still has a place in my heart for him, but he was. There's a lot going on with his breeding behaviors and kind of built-in DNA stuff, triggers and all that.
Yep.
But with training and reinforcement, you know, he was at my knee, didn't have a problem. Never ripped my arm out of socket. Like, my gosh, yeah, that's a. It's not healed, but it's this thing of he needs to know when we go out, you can have fun, you know, but we're gonna take it at your pace, and you're gonna go to your knee, and that's it. And if people show up, that's okay, but you're gonna wait. And it's actually really fun when you can teach a dog to wait, and it does it. You're like, wow, you feel
fish.
Achieved. The dog feels achieved. It's great.
We have fish.
You have fish?
We have fish.
The dog has a fishing pole? What are we saying?
No. We have fish in an aquarium.
And the dog does what? Watches the fish?
No, he's not interested in the fish at all.
We took a left turn. Okay, I get it. All right, I missed it. All right, yeah.
It's my feeble attempt at British humor. I have fish.
Is that for your calm, the fish? No, there's a calming aspect to a dog. You trigger that and all of a sudden everything changes. They could be aggressive and all of a sudden they hit calm and like, oh wow, I'm not aggressive, there's nothing to be aggressive about. You have to knock them out of a pattern of thinking.
This guy's never aggressive. He's all positive energy.
Well, no, when he was moving forward and pulling on your arm, It was not aggression in the fact that it was anger, but it was a very forceful move on his part to dominate a circumstance. And it hurt your arm. I'm just saying, man, there's stuff you can do so you don't hurt your arm.
Yeah.
One is you could hook his harness around your belt.
Yeah,
the
pants thing has me petrified. My belt are on my pants.
Well, unless the dog is strong enough to break a leather belt or whatever your belts are made out of.
He might be.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I'm sorry. I've seen too many Stooges comedies. It could happen.
I think I had a brass hook with closure on it, and I had a loop on my belt, a metal loop, and I put it on there. And if I needed to be hands-free, I could let the harness go. He wasn't going to go anywhere training. But, you know, if I needed to, and then I just pick up the lead again and we start walking.
Well, if he wasn't going to go anywhere, why'd you take him for a walk for?
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
Stay at home.
Well, we had this conversation, you know, he and I did, and you know, over some beer and chips. And, it went deep into the night trying to figure out where we're going.
I have never given beer to a dog. I know some people have. I have not.
Oh, that, yeah, no. The, be, yeah. unless the dog can make it himself, he's not going to get beer or weird things. Okay, if he can't make it himself, sorry. Yeah.
Nope. You can't work the lighter. Can't have a cigarette.
Yeah, right.
No, he does not. Yeah, that's... No, he cigarettes don't even interest him. But my electronic cigarette, oh my God, he thinks it's the coolest thing in the world. I have no idea why.
Oh, okay.
He's weird. I love him.
Well, dogs work off of strong olfactory. Could be the
Maybe.
Smell's a little bit different than whatever it is
I don't
that
know.
You're doing with other cigarettes. I don't know. But dogs are cool. But there is a psychology of training to them that can be fun. And here is one of the things. This happened to me, and it terrified me to no end. I used to have a 4-foot chain link fence around my backyard,
mm-hmm.
and I had neighbors on one side, and it involved children. And you know, it's like, hey man, you know, there's a dog back here, and he's a big dog. And so one day, I'm out in the backyard, and one of the kids comes up to me and says, "Your dog bit me." And I was like, "Oh my God, okay." If it push comes to shove with that, depending on where it goes, it could end up being that you have to kill your dog. And I was horrified. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, wait, what was going on? It's like, well, I was in your yard and the dog bit me. I was like, well, why were you in my yard? You know,
yeah.
Like, hello. So I flipped it really quick on the kid, and I was like, well, you've had all your shots, okay? Because you know, I want to make sure he doesn't get sick. And the kid
right.
laughed it off and walked away, and that was it. But that could have gone in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
No,
did he just say he was bitten?
Did he just say he was bitten, or did he show you anything?
I never saw a wound or anything like that.
Okay.
My dog might have nipped at him. I don't know.
He might have been lying.
You know, could have been. I don't know why he would have done that, but you know that for any dog owner, that there's a bit of terror in that because
oh, yeah.
if that ever occurs, you know, you could say goodbye to your best friend,
yep.
or your furry son, or however you. I mean,
yeah.
to me, he was like my child, and I loved him for you know. So it was very. That was a scary moment. And that had nothing to do with training. He was in his space, and someone, if it occurred, someone came into his space. If they were in the yard, if they were in their yard doing whatever, he didn't bother them. He didn't go bark at the fence. He didn't charge the fence. It's a 4-foot fence. He was strong enough. He could have bounced over that fence. Nothing. Okay. So they ingressed into his territory. It's like, the hell are you doing? Excuse my French, but that was so. It was very scary for me as an owner.
I like it that you're so versed in other and in foreign languages, Gunnar.
Yes.
Such as what?
No, you said pardon my French, and you know I'm just so glad that you're versed in foreign languages.
Sacre bleu!
I don't have any French in me.
Yeah, some people are luckier than others, Dale.
I know I'm Norwegian and I'm Scott.
Oh, God,
I
have to tell you.
I
have a story to tell you offline.
Okay. Well, you've got my number.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And the tag can't get the tattoo to wear off. I can't get the tattoo to wear off there.
So run with it, man. Run
you'd,
with it.
You would have think it would have worn off by now. What with all the chafing. Anyway. Oh, God. This is horrible. Not bad, man.
Man, it must be time for you to take your dog for a walk, Dale.
Actually, he's been asleep.
Or the other way around. All right.
Yeah. He's not been fussing as much at night unless he really gets sight of an animal. Usually it's the possum at night. He wants to chase things.
But he does have a regular, like, bathroom schedule, like, okay, I got to go.
Not regular. He goes when he has to go. He tells us. It's like, dude, gotta go.
Okay.
All right. And he goes.
He's standing by the back door with his legs crossed. You know it's time.
No, he just has. I know his body language. They go.
And he hoots, right? No, he only hoots when he's doing it. Okay.
Sometimes he'll hoot at the door still.
Oh, okay.
Hoot, hoot.
But
hoot.
He usually comes and gets one of us when he wants to go out.
You're really lucky because some dogs don't give a hoot, you know?
Well, believe me, when he was outside, the kennel was outside at the breeder where he was born, so he was not used to indoor life. That took a little doing. About a week, and he was trained to go outside. Not even a week.
How old was he when you first gained ownership of him?
He was 6 months.
6 months. And 6 months, yeah, so, yeah.
He was about 4 months. Excuse me, 4 months. He was about four months.
Okay.
He was born in April. We got him in July, I think.
Yeah.
It was almost August, so he was almost 4 months old.
My first dog, Benny, was months old when I got him. It was amazing. Months, yeah. And then the second dog I got, Jim, was a year old. So he had a few habits that we modified.
Yeah.
To make him more rounded for being inside.
That's
a very good dog.
This one, me and the wife said, no, we're not having that indoors. This stops now.
We're not having what indoors?
Number one or number two?
No, you train him to go outside, yes. Yeah, Miles
yeah.
trained to go outside.
That was easy.
But he had other... Yeah, yeah.
What I do is just get some new, at some point, if he makes a mistake, you get some on some newspaper, one of each flavor, you stake it outside, you show him this is where it goes, let him sniff it and say, okay, you know. I mean, you don't shove his face in it, but you say, hey, see this goes outside. So do you.
Right. I think our training on that was directly after feeding, he would go out. He would be taken out.
That's a must after feeding because he generally has to go after eating.
Yeah. Well, you got to consider your dog is kind of like a Play-Doh fun factory. You know, so if you put it in, it's got to come out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. He's a collie. He doesn't talk about those things. He just winks and I know he has to go.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeps it to himself, really? But every once in a while, I'd
yeah,
give you that look. Hey man, get up, man. Come on.
He belches a lot, which is odd.
Let's talk about baloney.
I don't give him baloney.
I think my
not the best thing to give a dog.
My dog's used to.
That's why I said
yeah,
talk about baloney.
Well, I'd rather him belch than anything else, any other emissions. Some people have dogs that
I've seen my dogs
have that issue.
It's kind of just a smooth, not like a bark, you know. I mean, yeah, but you know.
Nah, he sounds like a little person.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Kind of weird because he's such a pretty dog to hear this coming out. He's got blue eyes. He's just gorgeous. I love him.
Yeah.
And
I've seen the photos. He's a beautiful.
Oh, it took forever for that mane to grow out because, like, when we first got him, you know, you could see the beginnings of a mane there, but, man, that really poofs out.
Mm-hmm.
And the hair is not as bad as you think. They really only – they blow their coat right around their birthday every year, the boys. The girls blow it a couple times a year, I think. It's called blowing their coat. And you get lots of what we call collie sprinkles. It's these little clots of hair that look like little sprinkles. So for about a month, but if you just brush them out like once a week, he looks real good.
Yeah.
You know, with all that hair, you'd think, oh, my God, it's a nightmare every day. Not really. Not really.
Yeah.
Not too bad.
You never found any big balls under the bed?
Of hair?
Of fur?
No.
Oh, that's good.
No, we have this invention. They call it a vacuum cleaner.
Do you have a Roomba thing that wanders around your house? Is that when you're?
I'm not a Roomba fan, and Actually, we get more for the cat. I have to vacuum much more often for the cat than for the dog.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy since my dog passed several years ago now. When I change out the air conditioning filter, it lasts a lot longer now than it did before.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine with all the dander around here between a bird, cat, dog. Birds give off a lot of dust and stuff. Bird dust.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I know you've had a lot of animals. Have you had any birds?
Yeah, we had a cockatiel. We had a cockatiel.
Yep.
We had an owl, and we had what else was there?
A goonie bird.
That would be freaking huge. No, we had some parakeets.
Pelican?
But the biggest one was the cockatiel. The cockatiel, it was weird. We kind of an odd thing when I first met the cockatiel. It was like, okay, well, I'm going to stay over here, and I'm just an angry bird. And it was like, okay, you know. And then some time passed, and I came back and visited, and all of a sudden the cockatiel was like, hey, man, how are you? Let me get on your shoulder and just kind of hang out. And that bird, all of a sudden, every time I came into my parents' home, they were like, oh, come here, man. And I was like, okay.
Was he the kind that had, like, the yellow head?
Yeah, yellow head. I think...
Because, like, there's a pearl.
And he had something on his head.
My wife used to raise them.
Right.
It feels.
Mm-hmm.
And they can talk. Did yours talk?
Mm-hmm. He made noise. I never heard him speak. My mom had another one that did talk, but this one.
No
he was,
whistle.
He was a secondhand
stuff.
Bird.
Yeah.
The second one that she had, I tried to go over and make nice with it, and it was like, nah, get out of here. Don't want anything to do with you. But one thing is he was a secondhand bird, and the bird cussed more than most sailors I knew. If somebody came down the driveway.
Wait a minute. I want to know how you priced this. When did you last purchase a sailor?
I was a sailor. What do you mean?
You said it cost more than a sailor.
You said it cost more than a sailor, yeah.
Cusses. Profanity.
Oh, cusses.
Oh, cusses.
Ah,
oh,
I thought
you said cost. Yeah.
Yeah, so did I.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Okay, now I get
it. No, this bird was profane. I mean, just my gosh! Someone came walking down the driveway there.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you heard all of this cussing and screaming going on. I was like, "What is it? It's the bird."
Yeah.
the bird was situated in the front window, so he would see if someone came.
And he would cuss.
And he was like the first defense. You son of a I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, you can tell they
like, well,
grew up in a
here.
Rough environment there. We had a neighbor that had a bird, and they were always fighting over there, and that thing learned how to cuss and swear. And wow.
And the only thing is, I don't know that much about bird psychology. I know more about canine psychology, but I don't know how you would untrain a bird if it gets
Denise would tell you they're kind of funny. And they imprint a lot. And I think what happened with that particular bird you were talking about is, although it wasn't real cool with you at first, I think it grew to miss you. You know what I mean? And when it saw you, oh, there's something familiar. And imprinting has a lot. Sometimes if you resemble someone who is mean to them, or they'll favor a particular gender. Sometimes it's a guy. Sometimes it's a girl.
Yes.
And then if the owner's a girl, they might favor females more than males, humans, you know.
I ran across an animal. I don't know if it was a dog or a bird or a cat or whatever, but I was told there was some type of cruelty going on, and whoever it was wore a hat. And so I was told, you know, because I always wear a fedora when I'm out and about. I think so. I might have worn a baseball hat years ago, but more fedora. And so my mom would say, you know, you need to, you know, get rid of it. And I never got rid of the hat, and the animal came right up to me, and it was like, well, so much for the it's afraid of people with hats. It's afraid of certain people with hats.
They can be funny about certain things. Birds are really weird, and they you know, some of the parrots are extremely intelligent. Lucy's pretty smart. She knows a lot of words, and it sounds like her and Denise are having a conversation sometimes that actually makes sense. Now, I don't know if it's repetition or if she really sometimes I think she comprehends certain things. She certainly knows how to ask for certain treats that she wants, like apples and grapes. She will ask for them by name.
That's really cool.
And she knows the difference. She knows the difference. If you try to trick her, it's like, no, that's not apple. I want an apple.
They had a psychologist working with a dog, and the dog ended up having, it knew 300 different words and association of forms. And it was like,
amazing.
Good grief. Because now it's bringing us to understand that these animals, we can communicate with them much more than just stop, don't, this, that, whatever, you know. Just our limited.
I learned, and I'm not as good as her, but I learned from Denise, too, a lot of the language of animals has to do with body language.
Mm-hmm.
And
emotion.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
And emotion.
Yes.
If you're in a certain emotional state, the animal will detect it and go, well, you're okay to be around, or I need to get away from you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I learned that at a young age. If you show you're not afraid, a dog is usually approachable. Usually.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell when they're not.
I went on a nature hike today. We have a botanical garden. I went there today. I was walking around, and they had koi fish floating around. I was like, wow. But see, here in Florida, if there's water, could be gators, you know? And I'd be like, there sure is a lot of koi fish for there being something in there. So
maybe not for long.
Bereft of alligators.
It could be the dinner bell for gators.
Yeah.
It would be. Yeah. Alligators do migrate from water body to water body. So that, I asked them about what
Anthony
type of wildlife,
Gopher.
You know. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I asked them about any type of wildlife they might have there, and they said, someone had seen a bobcat in the parking lot. And I was like, why in the heck would a bobcat be in a parking lot? I'm like, that's one confused bobcat.
Because they can.
Looking for a place to park.
Because they can.
Yeah,
or hitching a ride or begging for quarters. I don't know what the
begging
knows,
for quarters. What's this bobcat going to do with a quarter?
Well,
I mean, what does a
quarter
buy anymore?
You need a quarter to get into Aldi, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, if you want a cart, anyway.
Yeah, and every bobcat would want a cart, so.
I went into an Aldi's recently. I can't do it, man. I just can't do it.
Why is that?
I did it one time, and I said nope.
Yeah, it doesn't look appealing to me. It doesn't look appealing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the prices aren't that much better than some of the places I go.
Oh, it's this weird thing. I haven't gotten this down at all. It's like piecemeal shopping. Like if you go to this store, you buy this, but you don't buy that. If you go to this store, you buy this, but you don't buy that. And you save money by buying this here and buying this there. And I'm like,
I only look at the saving money though if I'm going that way. Like I won't drive extra for one sale. You'll blow more in gas than you save at the.
Oh, no, you'd have to piece it together. Yeah, like a big list of like you know, 10 items at this store, 10 items at this store, or maybe more.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's just. I went to Sam's Club today.
Our Walmart is kind of far, where the grocery store is real close. But Walmart's much better for certain items, so if I happen to be headed farther away for other errands, then I'll go there.
Yeah.
Right.
I will go to Aldi's myself. I buy my apples there a lot of times. They have keto bread there that's like a buck and a half cheaper than anywhere else, and you know, things like that.
Well, the one by me is kind of far, and it's like, I'd really have, because there's some things you can't screw up, like an apple. I mean, you can't mess up an apple.
Yeah.
No, but you can look at the price of the price variation. But an apple's an apple for the most part. Like, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, like quality of stuff, you know.
Well, right. I don't have trouble with their apples. I even picked up a bag from just this week from Save-A-Lot, and I wasn't sure about that, but they're good. But they're good apples, so you know.
There you go. I haven't gone to a Save-A-Lot. I haven't been to a bunch of, but yeah, I don't know. I do not particularly enjoy the Walmart. I don't know why. I've just if I have to find a certain specific thing and it's only there, then okay. But pretty much.
No, I will say they used to have a lot more variety of things than what they have now. They have less variety, and you have to buy it online and have it shipped to the store, that kind of stuff. That I'm not crazy about.
Yeah, I'm not. I hate the self-checkout thing, too. It's like, why are you looking in my bag? You could have been looking in my bag and ringing it up for me, you goddamn.
This was crazy because Sam's was trying this out. Sam's was trying out the self-checkout thing. Today I went to Sam's. They had all of these registers, and they were all manned by Sam's employees at the register. They were ringing you up. No more of that stuff. And that was one of the curiosities about Walmart. Walmart is saying, there's so much theft and this, that going on. It's like, then get rid of your self-checkout. Instead of having 40 registers and you're all, use them. You put them in there, and regulate what's going into a bag and what's doing this and what's doing that.
It's not rocket science.
It's not an assault to the customer to have someone bag your groceries. It protects the customer and it protects the store. So, and they're moving away from that.
I know.
It's odd. But today I went to Sam's and like every one of their registers, like there was somebody there.
There's none around here, but I read about McDonald's that does not have a single person inside. It's all completely automated.
Automated?
Yeah. Yep.
Everything about it is automated.
Yeah, I can't.
That sounds more like the Asian model that made it into the U.S.
I saw X-Files with something like that, and it didn't turn out pretty. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't. I'm not liking it. Who's in charge of cleanliness of something like that? I mean, come on. You got to have certain cleanliness standards, don't you?
Yeah, the robots have to wash their hands, you know.
Yeah, before they return to work, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're probably smarter than people. You don't have to leave a freaking sign to tell you that.
Well, I think in some cases
you do, yeah. I've met some of those people.
I know, it just amazes me. You have to leave a sign in the washroom at a restaurant, please wash your hands before returning to the kitchen.
Right.
They put that sign up for the customers more than they do the workers, if you get my drift.
They might.
No, the wordage is geared towards the people that work there when it says employees must wash their hands. But I just ran across this odd occurrence. I have not been to a restaurant. I personally have not gone to a restaurant since 2019. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with and I met a friend of mine, and we had I don't remember when the heck you and I when we met. I don't remember when that was. Was that 2019?
I think it was 2019. Yeah.
Okay.
Just before
because
the fun.
There were no masks, no quarantine. So I hadn't really gone to a restaurant before then, and I don't like going to restaurants. I prefer to process my own raw materials into food here in the house, in the kitchen. I clean off. It's all, you know, I know where, you know, stuff's been. So I have a friend of mine coming into town this weekend, and they're like, yeah, find a restaurant. I'm like, oh, my gosh, a restaurant. Oh, man. So
Of them probably went out of business since you've been outdoors last.
Yes. Oh, that. See, okay. Yeah, I had gone to a restaurant, and it was like they sold steak, and they also served fish. And I went, and I met a friend, and it was okay. And I was like, all right. And I went looking for that restaurant. It doesn't exist anymore. The pandemic killed it.
Yep.
So we're going to that fallback that I went and met Dave and his wife at. I'm going to the Cracker Barrel.
The Cracker Barrel.
The Cracker Barrel. I think it's good food.
They have pretty good food. I like them.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on behind the wall, but okay, well, yeah.
You never do.
I have an immune system that I, you know, should be able to, you know, take care of it. So
it's weird how certain chains are different. Like, we had a chain out here called Ponderosa. It was like a steak place,
yeah.
You know.
I know
affordable,
that one. Yeah, steakhouse.
Affordable,
yeah.
Steak. You could go to one and it's, oh my God, it's horrible. And you can go to another and everything is just like almost exquisite. It's so weird.
Wow.
It's so weird.
All has to do with the top management. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, management. That's it.
People will respect what you inspect, and that's what I learned a long time ago in restaurant management. Yeah.
One of my 5,628 jobs was assistant manager in a restaurant. And you know, you make sure everything's okay. And if you don't, you know, your customers could die, or you know, people are not going to come back. So, you know, one of the things.
And then your business dies. Yay!
Yay! And then there's a pandemic. Yay! Yeah.
Isn't it over yet?
I don't know.
What? Are we winding down?
I think we're winding down. So.
I think they're turning it off later this year.
Turning what off?
Turning what off?
The pandemic.
I think they're turning it off.
Oh, no. No. It'll be with us until we die. It's with us, you know.
But it won't be a pandemic anymore. It will be.
We hope.
Like, yeah. It will be, right. They will be like the flu and other things like that. That you need to get shots for every year and things like that.
I'm done.
Stuff.
Yeah, I've gotten the three and the booster, and I'm kind of like, okay, we're kind of done. I don't know if I'm going to go for a fourth. I'm like, yeah, I did it, you know. I've done all the things that I need to do to be able to go out in public without a mask on, you know, and people around me are protected, I'm protected, and, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do.
That's why I usually wear my Richard Nixon mask, you know, when I go out, so.
I am not a cook. Yeah, that guy. we love him.
Well, shall I bring him in, Dale?
We shall.
All right.
We shall. All right. Good night, guys.
It's time to shut off the house lights, turn on the three spotlights, and wait for the schnozzle to step into the middle of spotlight.
Good night, everyone. Good night. Whatever you are. Good
night. Good night.
What a winner.
It's time to say good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.
What more to say but good night?
We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Arrivo, up we the same, and
ink-a-dink-a-doo.
Good night. Good night.
Good night, folks, and good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever.
She's over there.
What are you doing over there?
Everywhere.
Martians are all gone. Thanks.